obligated to obey the civil laws of the government that they are in. We discussed there are different origins for that rule. How do you know such a rule? Some predicated on the verse in Jeremiah, seek the welfare of the society you're in. That's a verse in Jeremiah. Others, such as Rashi, predicated, you'll recall, on the seventh Noahide law that says non-Jewish societies are empowered to make laws to administer justice, and consequently a Jew is governed by those laws. And yet a third group is the rental theory. This is articulated by a rabbi called Ran. Ran is an abbreviation, Rabbeinu Nissen, who lived in the 14th century in Spain, who was a great... Rashi says, because Bnei Noach commanded on Dinim. And the Ran uses the rental theory, that since a king or a government has the right to deny anybody occupancy unless they pay rent, the rent is obedience to the law of the realm. I had mentioned that according to Rabbeinu Nissan, we get the very surprising conclusion that precisely in the state of Israel, like this opinion, Jews would not have to obey the law of the land because no government has the right to impose a condition on my right to live in this land. This is Jewish land. Now, many people don't follow the Iran, of course, but if you will talk to some rabbis in Israel who might tell you you don't have to pay Israeli taxes, part of that would be based on this opinion. Now, again, I'm not advocating this. In fact, I would advocate that you don't follow this opinion, but nevertheless, there is a basis in halacha for the idea that rent cannot be imposed on a Jew who wants to live in Eretz Yisrael.
It's just not necessarily referred to it during the temple period or time like that.
Are you talking about to the Roman government or the Jewish government? Yeah, but that might be very different. When you have a religious government, then it's not just a question of obeying its secular government. That's already, Torah talks about a king and everything else. That's a separate principle that you have to obey what the king proclaims. But we're dealing with the issue of obedience to the secular government. And the state of Israel, even though most of the government officials are Jewish, it is a secular government. The state of Israel does not run by the laws of the Torah. Again, I'm not criticizing it, but it's just the reality. Then there would be a separate principle, not Dina de Malchusetina, but simply that the Torah recognizes the rights of a Jewish government to impose laws. So that would be a separate rule, though. This is Jeremiah, Yirmiyahu. This is Dirshu Shlomir, which is also the source of the obligation in Pirkei Avos to pray for the welfare of the government. Based on that particular verse, which is why people recite the prayer for the United States in many synagogues, and also, well, the prayer for the state of Israel is not because it's, I mean, even if you're a Kutbar, people say that. That's a separate thing. That's just to express solidarity with Israel. By the way, just a little bit of, I think I may have mentioned this, that the authorship of the prayer of the state of Israel is actually a very well-known author. The author was Agnon, Shmuel Agnon, was an Israeli novelist who was the first Israeli to win the Nobel Prize for Literature in, I think, 1962. And he wrote in Hebrew and Yiddish. So it was interesting. I don't know who I guess it had been translated. And he was a religious man, although I just read 2 days ago, that apparently he became a Baal Shuv. He was raised in a religious home, he had left it, and then later he had become religious, and he's the author of the prayer of the state of Israel. Okay.
Is he the one that
saved them? Right, that's the Anochi Yafavieh, right? Dust and ashes, right. So, this Dina de Malchusedina is a very important rule, because it does say Jews, I mean, other than the Israel thing that we just talked about, but it does say Jews are supposed to pay taxes. Now, that doesn't mean you have to be machmer in taxes. For example, there's a well-known legal distinction between what is called tax avoidance and tax evasion. If you have a good accountant or a good lawyer that figures out loopholes that are legal, in halacha there might be a concept of going beyond the letter of the law. When it comes to Dina de Malchusedina, you don't have to go beyond the letter of the law. You don't have to say, well, the letter of the law says I don't have to pay this tax, but the spirit of the law, you know, would encourage me. I mean, you don't have to do either mitzvah. I'm paying taxes. So anything that is a legal way of minimizing is perfectly kosher. That's even mechatchila. But to cheat, to evade what you clearly do owe, like understating income, that is an avera based on Dina de Malchus Adina. Now, as I said before, the scope of Dina de Malchus Adina is very, very controversial. There are many, many opinions, and there are whole sforim written just on this concept of Dina de Malchus Adina. The minimum absolute core that everybody agrees is Dina de Malchus Adina is taxes. So when it comes to taxes, there's no disagreement. Okay, so that's the one single thing. When it comes to other things, though, there are a lot of different opinions.
Can I just ask
Taxes? Sure.
In the days in which Dina Malchus Adina was established or was practiced, the governments, unlike governments of today, weren't involved in supporting poor people. That was done through tzedakah.
Yes, correct.
So, I have an agenda, obviously. When I pay my taxes,
a lot of it goes to social welfare.
Right. Is that considered tzedakah as part of the 10% of my income?
That's a very, very interesting question. In fact, somebody just asked me that question yesterday, too. I got an email. You have to give 10% of your income for charity. So the question becomes, can I figure in that portion, assuming I could estimate that, let's say, 20% of tax money is used for poor people. So if I pay, let's say, $5,000 of taxes a year, can I assume that $1,000 is going to charity, and as a result, I can, in calculating my 10% charity obligation, can I deduct $1,000? I want to research it. I believe you can. Customarily, that has not been done because you get into some questions in terms of whether the non-Jewish causes that are being supported, are considered charity, but. At least in Israel, let's say, where the bulk of it devoted to Jewish causes, the bulk of the beneficiaries of social welfare are Jews. I don't see any reason why you couldn't, but I do want to check it. I think that's absolutely true, because in the time of the Talmud, in fact, even after the Talmud, charity was an enforceable obligation. In other words, there were separate charity taxes levied on individuals or residing in the community. So one can fulfill tzedakah even if one is forced to cough up the money. But it's a very, very interesting question.
Isn't that the main issue, though, that the charity, the 10%, has to be to Jewish charities? And in secular society, you're not, most of it isn't, if any at all.
Yeah, I think in the United States, I think there would be a real problem. In the state of Israel, it would appear that although the charities are not earmarked as Jewish, but number one, first of all, a lot of your tax dollars in Israel go to yeshivas directly. Israel does not have separation of church and state. Now, if I were to give money to a yeshiva, that clearly would satisfy my tzedakah obligation. So the question is there any difference between my handing it over to the yeshiva and my handing it over to the government, which then funnels it to the yeshiva. Right? So I can't see why that wouldn't be the case, but again, I want to think about it some more because it has some very interesting implications. I'll try to think about it and come back with a better answer. In terms of what else does Dina de Malchus Adina embrace besides taxation? So here, many commentaries and opinions say that in order to be Dina de Malchus Adina, it must be a law that pertains, side either to taxation or to laws that affect and are for the benefit of the general public at large. You'll see what this is excluding. So, for example, rules regarding safe conditions in the workplace, health, minimum wage, right, for how much you have to pay somebody, hours, people can't work more than whatever it is, 40 or 50 hours a week, whatever the occupational safety, right, the types of things that, the requirements in a factory as to how things have to be set up to minimize injury. Those types of things, generally speaking, Jews are obligated to follow because of Dina de Malchus Adina. Speed limits, which raises a very interesting question, it would stand to reason that a Jew is halakhically obligated to follow a posted speed limit because that is a law that is enacted to protect the public, to protect pedestrians, protect other drivers, etc. And therefore, this would fall squarely within Dina de Malchus Adina. Well, that's interesting. That probably is true. If you go back to the 70s, 55, it was because of the energy crisis. That's correct. Although, once again, even if that would be the reason, one could say that the need to conserve oil or gas at a time of scarcity or embargo is also to protect the public and protect the economy, although it's not a safety thing. But today, I think it's also been accepted. I know in many places, well, as you know, now in the states are free to raise, I don't know if any of you have been in these states since that happened, but they can raise the speed limit. And in a lot of places, certain stretches of highways are now 70, back to 70. 75, and in some places, the 75 kind of the rural areas and the like. And there's been a lot of discussion. Some people claim that raising the speed limit will cause many more people to die. Other people say it's actually safer when you have a straight highway for traffic to go a bit faster. It might be safer because when it slows up, people crash into each other and everything else. But be it as it may, I do know that there were rabbis who were very, very strict about not going over the speed limit. And not only that, but at stopping at red lights and stop signs. I read a story about the Rabbi Kamenetsky. He was with somebody at 3 o'clock in the morning at an intersection. I mean, there was not a car for miles. And the guy was just going to go through. And of course, a lot of lights go on flash, etc. But this happened to just be a red light. So the guy was going to drive through it. I mean, nobody was coming. There were no police, and nobody was coming. And if Yaakov said, no, you got to stop, and you got to wait for the light to change, because this is the law. Now, you'll ask me the question, so many Jews, like everybody else, you know, break the speed limit, and they go what? If they go 56, or they go 60, they're doing a sin? So here we get into a very interesting issue about Dina de Malchus Adina, and that is, how do you define what the law really is? Do you define a law by what it says, or do you define a law by how it's enforced? Now, in halacha, that's not a question. In halacha, the halacha is the halacha no matter what, whether people enforce it or not. I mean, we don't have enforcement of halacha today anyway. But for Dina de Malchus Adina, it's a much more tricky question. That is my religious obligation to obey the law as it's written, or is my religious obligation to obey the law as it's commonly enforced? So if, for example, a policeman is not going to pull you over till you go 5 to 10 miles over the limit, so the question then becomes, for Dina de Malchusa Dina purposes, is the speed limit 55? Or is the speed limit 60? Now, even then, it's really not much of a hetcher to go 80 or 85, but l'chol ha'pachos, one can use the argument that a law gets redefined. Yeah?
And you're from the Baltimore area, also from Washington.
Right.
You go to the Baltimore, the average speed
That's correct. That's right.
So going 55 there could be dangerous.
I think that's right. I think that's a very excellent point, and I think you're 100% correct. If going at the posted limit is sakana, which it might be if everyone's going much faster, then clearly the need to drive safely will override the obligation to obey government law. Because it would even override the obligation to obey Jewish law, right? So kal v'chomer, as it were. In other words, if you're allowed to violate Jewish law in order to protect your life and prevent a dangerous situation, then certainly this would yield. So you're correct. I mean, that would be a judgment that a reasonable driver would have to make. But in the absence of a danger, let's say, there is this concept, you got to obey the law. And again, some have taken the position that you have the liberality to define the law by how it's commonly enforced for purposes of Dina de Malchus Adina. A related issue, and this comes up a lot, is what happened to Zoe Baird. If you remember the name from the past, she was the very first nominee to be Attorney General in Clinton's administration. She actually is from my town of Hartford, Connecticut. And she was not confirmed. Her nomination was withdrawn because of what they call nanny gates. If you remember what nanny gate is, you know, she had a cleaning lady or a babysitter or something. And when you pay a cleaning lady, you know, people always pay in cash, you don't give a cleaning lady a check, so you pay $50 a week, you're supposed to withhold a certain portion of that wage for Social Security, because she's an employee. So yeah, so as an employer, you have to pay a little portion of her wage to the government as a Social Security contribution. Now, virtually nobody does this. I mean, nobody does this at all. And she didn't do it either, you know, but since she was, and of course, especially, I guess, if it's Attorney General, whose job is to enforce all the laws. So the truth is, I mean, it was kind of vindictive for Congress, you know, to get her because of that. But they had a Pesach that gave them a certain excuse.
How could they prove that?
Well, she didn't lie. I mean, she wasn't going to lie. I mean, you know, they suspected.
Well, Social Security has records.
Well, they have records that the no money came in, right?
They don't have records of the cleaning industry.
Yeah.
About Tuesday, though.
Yeah, but it was one of those things where, you know, you have to understand, when in politics, when they want to find something, you know, I mean, they're going to ask the neighbors, oh, did she have a woman who came in, you know, every week, you know what I mean? They'll ask the neighbors, and they'll offer them a lunch or something, and they'll get the
it's
information.
It's like her doing a civil suit about sex.
Yeah, also, again, technically a crime, but, you know, big deal in a way, you know. The case was dismissed anyway, besides, it wasn't even a live case. So, but one has to be very careful, because the question becomes, well, if I'm a religious Jew and I am obligated to obey the laws of the land, and the laws of the land say I am supposed to pay in that Social Security, even if nobody else does it, does that give me a right not to do it? It would appear not, unless you can show that the government never bothers to enforce this. And the truth is, after the Baird case, it's hard to say the government doesn't care, because
isn't
apparently
it a little bit like
they do care.
The question I started the session with is, you may not be obligated to do it.
Yeah.
But should you do it anyway?
Yeah, that's a second level of issue. But I'm even suggesting you might be obligated to do it. See, Dina de Machusadina could be very, you know, a lot of things that we don't take so seriously. Halacha may require that we do take very, very seriously and conscientiously in terms of doing our job, and that's besides the whole other layer of sanctifying God's name and desecrating God's name, which even if you can get away with it according to halacha, you know, you have all of those issues. So there's a lot of things to be sensitive to. Now, here, however, there's one important qualification that some commentaries say, and they say that although I am obligated to obey all the government laws, etc., but when it comes to my relation between one Jew and another Jew, in other words, we make a contract, or I do something to you, etc., between one Jew and another Jew, individually, one-on-one, the relationship is supposed to be governed by the laws of the Torah, and not by the civil law. Let me give you an example. Let's say, for example, under secular law, if Reuven and Shimon make a contract, right? Reuven and Shimon make a certain contract. The contract is interpreted to mean a certain thing. Or the damages for breaking the contract are a certain type of thing. And under Jewish law, the result would be different. Well, many opinions take the position that as between a Reuven and a Shimon, their interactions are to be governed not by what secular law says, but they are to be governed by the principle of halacha, of choshen mishpat. Choshen mishpat, this is a part of the Shulchan Aruch that a lot of people don't even know exists. You know, the Shulchan Aruch is the code of Jewish law based on the Talmud, okay? So all of us know the part of it, well, we don't know it, we know of it. All of us know of the part of the Shulchan Aruch that deals with keeping Shabbos and keeping Pesach and davening, right? And all of us know that there's part of the Shulchan Aruch that deals with the laws of keeping kosher and the like. And all of us even know there's a part of the Shulchan Aruch dealing with marriage and divorce. But how many of us even are aware of the fact that there's a whole portion of the Shulchan Aruch that deals with contracts and partnerships and inheritances and business transactions, that there's Jewish law governing that? And even if Dina de Malchusa Dina says, I have to obey the government laws vis-a-vis the government and vis-a-vis the general public, but when it comes to how I deal with you in our contracts and our torts, there are many opinions, not universally, that say we do not apply Dina de Malchus Adina, but we apply Choshen Mishpat, we apply the provisions of the Shulchan Aruch.
Does this have an implication in the Jonathan Pollard case?
in terms of whether he should go to jail.
He had a relationship with another Jew, an Israeli Jew, that he may, in his mind, he may have been saying this was saving a life. By giving intelligence information, he was obligated to do that to save Jewish lives.
Well,
but you're violating American law.
Yeah, well, once again, it's a tricky thing. If he honestly believed that not giving this information could result in deaths that could be avoided by giving this information, then it would appear clear, that's not even based on what I'm saying now, it would appear clear that pikuach nefesh, saving a life, overrides any duty a Jew has to obey the law of the land. In the absence of pikuach nefesh, it would appear the law of the land would be binding on him. When I said, as between Jews, you follow kosher and mishpat, I didn't mean he could be a spy for giving information to a Jew. I just meant that if we have business dealings or contracts or the like, or a lease, it should follow the Choshen Mishpat. So let me give you an example of a particular issue here. Let's take, for example, something like bankruptcy. You know, I actually teach bankruptcy, so I'm a little familiar with it. Like, bankruptcy is a proceeding. There are different types of bankruptcies, called Chapter 7, Chapter 11, but basically a bankruptcy involves a guy that owes a lot of people money. He doesn't have enough assets to pay everybody up. So under federal law, there's a procedure that you can do one of two things, basically. He can either have his property liquidated, meaning everything that he has is sold, liquidated, creditors are paid off, maybe a very small fraction on the dollar. They might get paid off 10 cents on the dollar, okay? And the rest gets wiped off the slate. In other words, he doesn't have to pay anymore. No, that's called the discharge. If it's a Chapter 11 or a Chapter 13, instead of liquidating, he just proposes a repayment plan that I'll pay you over time. That is, I'll keep my property, I'll pay you over time. But even then, that doesn't mean they'll get everything. He may propose a plan to give people 30 cents on the dollar over time. The common denominator is whether he's doing it by liquidating or whether he's doing it by a repayment plan, creditors may only get a fraction of what they're owed, and the rest gets wiped off the slate. That's called discharge, right? Bankruptcy discharge. That's why people file for bankruptcy. Now, not everything gets erased. No, alimony sticks around. Taxes, as you would expect, by and large, stick around. Student loans stick around, because Congress was afraid of medical students, you know, who are getting nothing as interns, wiping out, you know, $100,000 and then getting kind of rich doctors. So student loans stick around. But by and large, a lot of things get erased. A lot of credit card bills, a lot of medical expenses. You can erase a lot of stuff. Now, here's the question. Under Jewish law, non-payment of a debt is a theft. Right? If I don't pay you money that I owe you, I am considered a gozlan. I am stealing. So here's the question. If I am a religious Jew who is in financial distress, and as a result I file for bankruptcy, and I get the benefit of a discharge that erases the loan from the erases my loans, am I halachically obligated, notwithstanding the bankruptcy, to pay the creditor anyway? Because here, secular law says you don't have to pay. Jewish law says you do have to pay. Generally, now Jewish law doesn't give you. I mean, we discussed Jewish law has shemitah, which can cancel a loan. But let's say the guy made a prisbo, right? So you don't even have shemitah, or it's not shemitah yet. So Jewish law, other than shemitah, does not give you any excuse not to pay your debt. So the question is, can an Orthodox Jew get the benefit of a bankruptcy discharge? So, it would appear the following. Vis-a-vis his non-Jewish creditors, there is no reason why he could not get the benefit of the discharge, because it's clear that secular law does apply in my relationship to my non-Jewish creditors. Meaning, if secular law permits such a thing as a bankruptcy, then mimela, I am permitted to use it. Now, again, don't misunderstand me. Obviously, as we said many times, you can't cheat a non-Jewish creditor. But here, bankruptcy is a legal option. It's legal. It's not illegal. It's not fraud. Assuming you're not engaged in fraud or deception, you're simply doing what secular law allows you to do. Okay, remember, we're not talking about cheating. So if you're doing what secular law allows you to do vis-a-vis your non-Jewish creditors, it would appear that that's all right. But what about my Jewish creditors? Now, here you might say, well, okay, but bankruptcy should work because of the principle of Dina, the Malchusa Dina. But you see what the problem is. If we say Dina de Malchusa Dina is only limited to rules for the general public and taxation, like health, environment, but as between me and my fellow Jew, I am obligated to follow the laws of the Torah, then the laws of the Torah say I'm supposed to pay my debts. I'm not supposed to escape it. So it would appear, at first glance, that, in other words, a Jew is allowed to file for bankruptcy, but he would then have to make some arrangements to pay back his Jewish creditors in full. And by the way, legally this can be done. This is called a reaffirmation. A reaffirmation simply means that even after you've gone through it, you agree to pay back one or more specific... In other words, I may have 100 creditors, I can erase 98 of them, and I might decide to pay two or whatever it is, any number. And you know, why would a person do that? From a secular perspective, there are a lot of reasons. I mean, let's say, I'll give you a very simple example. I like to call this the orthodontic example. Let's assume that you have a lot of kids who unfortunately have genetically bad teeth, right? So everybody needs braces. So for the first three kids, you've incurred $50,000 in orthodontia expenses. You then go through a bankruptcy and you erase the $50,000 plus a lot of other stuff. But now you have a problem. You still have kids number four and five to worry about. And you bring them to Dr. So-and-so. And Dr. So-and-so says, well, I can't force you to pay me the $50,000 you owe me, but if you think I'm going to work on four and five without getting paid for one, two, and three, you have something else coming. So what a person might do is, and again, and this is going to be an especially difficult problem if four and five are already, you know, embraces or whatever it is, and they need the guy to finish up the job. So because of this, it's very, very common for there to be what are called reaffirmations, which means even after you've erased the debt, you agree to pay a particular debt. But whatever it is, the suggestion we're making is that halacha may require that you selectively reaffirm your debts to Jewish creditors, because Dina de Malchusa Dina may not apply to allow you to avoid an obligation that the Torah puts upon you. This is one opinion. Again, I'm going to give you three opinions on this. So opinion number one is, this is the strictest opinion, a Jew is allowed to file for bankruptcy and get a bankruptcy discharge, but must selectively agree to repay his Jewish creditors in full, because as between the relationship of one Jew and another Jew, the only rule that governs is the law of the Torah and not the law of the governments, and therefore under those circumstances you cannot stiff your creditor by not paying him, because that would be considered halachic theft. That is view number one, a very, very strict view. Yeah.
There's no halachic basis that says that a Jew has to pay back a non-Jew?
Oh, okay. That's a very good question. It's true that in the abstract, a Jew has to pay back a non-Jew. But it's also understood that the halachic obligation of Jew towards non-Jew is defined by the non-Jewish society. Meaning to say, if non-Jewish society has laws that say you can get out of paying a non-Jew by bankruptcy, then that will govern the relationship. In other words, that's what I want to emphasize. We're not talking about cheating the non-Jew. We're not talking about deceiving him. We're talking about doing what the non-Jewish law says is legal. And so that would govern that. Now, there is opinion number two.
Happens if he's not able to pay that?
Well, then it's the same situation as any Jew. He doesn't have money to pay his creditor. So there's a mitzvah on the creditor not to harass him. We discussed that. And you work out some payment plan. You know, in other words, the creditor the creditor agrees to take less, but you have to work it out. In other words,
first got to be mindful of the money?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I can always, I mean, a creditor can always say you don't have to pay me. Now that's perfectly fine. All I'm saying is you need the. No, rivis is only when. Why would it be rivis? This is the opposite. This is when if I give you 1,000 and I tell you you don't have to pay me, I'm not giving you interest. That's a matana. Giving you a matana, mechila. I could be mochel $1 million. But the problem with bankruptcy is you're imposing it on the creditor of al karcha against his will. And that you can't do. That's considered to be theft. Now there is a view number two though, which says the following idea. And this is a very important principle in Jewish law of money. And that is, it is presumed that when parties do business with each other, when I do business with you, that it is part of our deal, even if we don't state it, even if we don't say anything, it is part of our deal that we are incorporating the common let me give you an example. You know, in the Gemara says in the Bava Basra, the Mishnah discusses when you sell things, what things are included in the sale, right? So when I sell you a horse and wagon, horse and buggy, so there are various bridles and various reins and various appurtenances, etc. What's included, right? When I sell you a house, are the lawn chairs included, right? All these questions, which, you know, sometimes we spell out, sometimes we don't, right? I sell you an office, do you get the bookcases? Right? How does halacha address that? So halacha says the following. Halacha says, hakol keminhag hamedina. All of these matters are to be determined by the prevailing custom in the locality. And that doesn't only mean a Jewish custom. By the average way. In other words, if you want to know, again, it's hard to know exactly how to determine that sometimes, but there is a concept that if you want to know what I'm selling you, when I sell you my office, I sell you a, whatever, I sell you a house, do I sell you the lawn chairs and do I sell you the power tools? You have to look at the custom in that particular locality, because unless they say the opposite, now they could say, they could say, befeirush, you know, we're not including it or we are including it. They could certainly override that. But if they don't say anything, if they don't say, the assumption is it is in their minds to follow the prevailing minhag hamakom. That is a great, great principle in Jewish civil law, which really has a parallel in secular law as well. Now, consequently, some poskim have made the following argument. When Reuven lends Shimon money in the United States or in any other country that has a bankruptcy law, it is understood at the time of the loan that there's such a thing in the world as an escape hatch that is called bankruptcy. And consequently, the ability to escape payment by a bankruptcy is considered to be a term, an implied term, or a tacit term in the loan itself. Now, let me give you an example. Let's assume I lent you money, and it says in the loan agreement, which you would never say, that it is that my obligation to pay is conditional on my not invoking bankruptcy. That would be a valid provision, because it was a condition. Well, if halacha regards all customs as implied conditions that come into the deal, then it's as if the loan was made on the understanding that if they file for a bankruptcy, they don't have to pay it back. And therefore, the reason it comes in is not because of dina d'malchus adina, not because of government law, but because of the principle of custom. See, that's a different thing. See, Dina de Malchus Dina would come in as an independent imposition of secular law. This comes in via the implied understanding of the parties to make that part of their agreement. According to that analysis, which many opinions adopt, a Jew would be permitted to invoke a bankruptcy law even against a Jewish creditor, because it is understood at the time of the transaction that this is an escape hatch. Now, I would suggest, though, that based on this, there might be a differentiation between different types of lenders. And that is the following. You can borrow $1,000 from a very sophisticated businessman who knows all of these laws, or you could borrow $1,000 from Aunt Tilly, you know, who's 85 years old, who has never heard of bankruptcy. So it would appear the following. If the basis for my being allowed to escape my obligation is because, since it was understood by the parties that there's this escape hatch, it becomes part of the agreement because of common consent, that would mean I don't have to pay the sophisticated guy who knew about it, but I would have to pay my aunt who didn't know about it. See, because you can't say my aunt agreed to this escape hatch by silence, because my aunt is not even aware that there is such an escape hatch, and therefore it wouldn't be possible. So ironically, it would mean the more knowledgeable, sophisticated people, see, like the, again, just like the first opinion, that bankruptcy doesn't work at all for a Jewish creditor, you have to pay everybody. Like the second opinion, one might say that there would be selective reaffirmation, meaning selective towards the ignorant and uninformed, and not towards the knowledgeable and sophisticated. Now, there is a third view in the bankruptcy process that says that since bankruptcy is essentially a social welfare program, bankruptcy is a mechanism to allow debtors to rejoin society again, we simply apply Dina de Malchusa Dina to bankruptcy. Now, that would mean that bankruptcy is legitimated not because it's agreed upon, but because second law allows it. According to that, you could stiff everybody. In other words, so we have three opinions. Opinion number one says you got to pay everybody. Pay everybody means pay every Jew. Opinion number two is you got to pay the unsophisticated, but you don't have to pay the sophisticated. Opinion number three is you don't have to pay any of your creditors, because Dina de Malchusa Dina will come in. So even something as relatively common as a bankruptcy does raise some very, very difficult and complicated halachic questions. How one should paskin, again, you have to talk to a posek about it if this is relevant. Different poskim do take different opinions about this. This would be the issue of something like a bankruptcy. So bankruptcy is one of the most blatant examples of a conflict between secular law and halacha, because secular law says you don't have to pay, halacha says you do have to pay, and the question is, to what degree will halacha allow you to use Dina de Malchusa Dina? Now, from everything that we're saying, it's absolutely clear, I hope you understand, that Dina de Malchusa Dina does not apply to mitzvahs between man and God. It doesn't apply to Shabbos, it doesn't apply to Kashrus, it doesn't apply to any of those things. But it may apply in the mitzvahs being Adam v'chaveiro, monetary obligations, and the like.
What about something like not charging interest?
That's also a major exception. It's very fascinating. That's why interest is so unique. Interest is, although it's a money, interest is treated like a kashrus law. It's not treated like a money law. And in fact, it's so fascinating. This is, I would guess, you know, the volume of the Shulchan Aruch that deals with monetary transactions is called Choshen Mishpat. But you know, the laws of interest are not in Choshen Mishpat. The laws of interest are in Yoredeya. Yoredeya is the part of the Shulchan Aruch that deals with kashrus, keeping kosher. That highlights the fact that interest is a very unique thing, because even if under secular law you're allowed to charge interest, it's absolutely clear halacha does not permit. In other words, interest is like, lending with interest is like eating chazir, in which no secular law can legitimate. It's very unique. It's not in the monetary laws at all. Who's Jewish?
And,
well, yeah.
And aside from that, very good. My response will be taken a step further on the ownership of certain companies that you live
with. I think you are obligated to find out. Now, there is a presumption in Chutz La'aretz that since most people are not Jews, there are many more non-Jews than Jews, so all cases of doubt, you can assume you're dealing with a non-Jew. But to the extent you can find out information to the contrary, you're obligated to do so, it would appear. Unless, of course, you adopt the third school of thought, that Dina de Malchusadina allows the wholesale incorporation of bankruptcy law, in which case, you know, you're off the hook, both for Jews and non-Jews. Let me just mention a few... I'm sorry.
Is there any distinction between observant Jews and non-observant Jews?
In this context, no. The obligation would be equal to both.
I'm obligated to pay to the Jews.
Yes, that would be the case. That's correct. Let me give you a few other examples of conflict between Jewish law and secular law, and see how these would be resolved. Let's take inheritance and wills. Right, so bankruptcy is one example. Let's take inheritance and wills as another example. You know, the Torah in the book of Numbers gives us a very detailed order for inheritance. The person dies and they have a son and a daughter. What does the Torah say? The Torah has a rule that many people have difficulty with understanding. The son gets everything and the daughter does not inherit. Now, if you remember, the precedent that was established by the daughters of Salatka, where their father had no children, so originally they didn't even know. Originally the claim was the father's brother should inherit, but God established somewhat of a liberalization of this policy, in the sense that if there's no sons at all, then a daughter inherits over an uncle, over a decedent's brother. But the halacha is still the case that if all you have is a son and a daughter, son gets everything. If there are two sons, as you know, the halakha is the firstborn, you know, two or more children, male children, the firstborn male not only inherits, but gets a double portion, gets twice as much as the other son.
What happens when the
second born doesn't have much money, and the firstborn, well, I'll discuss how this has been applied, but the halakha of the Torah says it makes no difference if you're rich or you're poor. The firstborn gets double the other son, even if the firstborn is a millionaire. Now, obviously, there are obligations of charity and tzedakah, which the firstborn owes towards his brother, but that's a matter of tzedakah. In terms of who has the right to the property, it is the firstborn. Now, let me just say right off the bat that one should understand that this does not leave girls totally without anything. I mean, in other words, let me say this. Number one, the halacha is very clear that there's an obligation on the estate, on the property that was inherited from the father, to support the women, to give them support. That includes shelter, food, clothing, and expenses in the manner to which they were accustomed when the father was alive. In other words, out of the estate, the girls get support, and if the estate is not that valuable, it could very well be it'll be totally used up in the support of the women. That's one thing. And the other thing is, when the girls reach the age of marriage, they are entitled rabbinically, to 10% of the estate as a dowry. Right, these are two distinct protections. One is a right to be supported at their brother's expense, which is enforceable in a beit din, until they get married. Second is a 10% dowry. Now, of course, you might be thinking, well, gee, what do you mean? What do we mean by a 10% dowry? Let's say there are 10 girls. So each girl gets 10%. What happens? So the Gemara actually says a very fascinating, complicated thing. If you're a tax lawyer, you follow this right away. Basically, it's 10% computed on a declining balance, and then it's redivided equally among the girls. But by this, we mean the following. Daughter number one, let's assume the estate at the time of death was $1 million. So, and to keep it simple, let's assume it stays $1 million. You know, just a non-interest-bearing bank account, just to make it simple. So daughter number one gets 10% of $1 million, which is $100,000. Daughter number two gets 10% of $900,000, because that's how much is left after you pay daughter number one. So she only gets 90,000. Daughter number three gets 10% of that. But what you then do is, you then take all the total distributions of all the girls, put them in a single pot, and divide it equally. Because it's not fair for daughter number one to get more money than daughter number two. So each woman's share is computed as 10% of a declining balance, but then it's redivided so everybody walks away equally. So, all right, but be it as it may, it is important to know that even under a strict halachic regimen, girls were not left with zilch. They were entitled to support, and they were entitled to the 10% dowry computation when they reach marital age. Yeah. Now with the wife, that's a good point. Let's go over the wife. Now you'll also notice a peculiarity of halacha, which is very, very different than any secular law, is that a wife does not inherit either. If a man dies and left a wife, left a widow, left a son, and left a daughter, the son owns 100% of that property. The daughter does not own it, and the wife does not get it. So, what is a wife's protection? So a wife's protection is roughly comparable to that of a daughter. The wife is entitled to be supported out of the estate in the manner to which she was accustomed. She is given the right to live in the marriage house. She doesn't own the house. The house belongs to the son. But she has the right to live in the house rent-free until she remarries. And then she's also entitled to a ketuvah, which is a lump sum payment, which isn't that much money. A ketuvah, in contemporary valuation, is probably around $5,000. But she does get a right to to live in the home and be supported in the manner to which she was accustomed. Now, this is all the pure halacha. Now, the question is, of course, that secular law has many, many different rules. Number one, secular law will often give the wife a third or even 50% of the whole estate. Secular law treats men and women the same. Sons and daughters inherit equally. Secular law does not give a firstborn a double portion. Although, interestingly enough, in Puritan America, if you go back to the laws of Plymouth Rock, actually they did say, they actually had in the secular law, which was religiously motivated, the right of primogeniture, which meant the right of a double portion of a firstborn. We don't have that today. So the question would be, and also, by the way, a secular law allows you to change everything by a will. Right? You can write a will, leaving everything to somebody else. You can take your next door neighbor, leave it to your cat. So the question becomes, all right, so if people don't keep Jewish law, they do what they want, we can't stop them. But the question is, I'm a religious Jew. I'm a halachic Jew. Can I write a will that changes this? Can I treat my daughters equally? Can I leave something to my wife? Or what if I am the beneficiary of a will? Let's assume that I'm a non-firstborn son, and my father has left me 50%. Am I allowed to keep that 50%? Or do I have to turn some of it over to my brother to give my older brother the double portion? Or if I'm a widow, am I allowed to keep the property that I was given by a will if under Jewish law it belongs to my son or to my stepson, right? These are very, very difficult questions of conflict between Jewish law and secular law. Now, what time do we have? Maybe we have to keep this one. Okay, so let me just speak for a few more minutes and we'll save the discussion for tomorrow. Now, some have said, well, since this pertains to property and money, Dina de Malchusa Dina might be the surrogate that takes care of all this. But on the other hand, if you remember, as I said before, like the opinions that say between Jews and Jews, you got to follow the Shulchan Aruch. So the question becomes, what are you allowed to do here? So this is going to be very important. In fact, you'll notice many charitable organizations and many yeshivas, including Or Sameach, will often say, please remember us in your wills. But you know, some people say, what do you mean remember in the will? In other words, you're asking a Jewish man, a Jewish person, to make a will leaving his money to Or Sameach when according to Jewish law, that money belongs to his son? If his son agrees, that's fine. But does Or Sameach have the right to take the money if the son says, I'd rather have it? Because under Torah law, it belongs to the son. Right? So some say, remember us in your will is treif. You're not allowed to even do that. Okay? So we'll discuss that. But that's going to be a very, very difficult issue of Dina de Malchusa Dina. Or, just to give you a third example, I did bankruptcy, inheritance, and wills. Another example would be divorce. When a Jewish woman is divorced, she does not have the right of support. Alimony is not really recognized in halacha. The only thing a Jewish woman gets when she's divorced is the amount of money in her ketubah, which, as I say, is around $5,000 to $10,000, depending on how you evaluate shkolim. So let's say it's $10,000. She certainly does not have a right to 50% of marital property or community property or something like that. So the question is a Jewish woman allowed to hire a divorce lawyer to get all of these things that secular law allows her to get if under Jewish law she's limited to her kesubah? Okay, again, another question. So these are very, very difficult issues. So when you learn Maseches Kesuvos and all those other things, these are not just theoretical. These are halachos, these are laws, and the secular law, and which is really a dilemma for a rabbi, I'll tell you, because often we get congregants, maybe women, who are going through a divorce, and they go to the rabbi and say, should I go to a rabbinical court, or should I go to secular courts? Now here's the problem. She can get much more, monetarily wise, going to a secular court. But it may be a, we'll discuss it, it may be a violation of halacha to do that. So on one hand, you may have to tell her, go to a Jewish court and have this adjudicated according to halacha, but the downside of that is that she may fare very poorly. A divorced woman does not necessarily have a lot of rights, property rights in Jewish law. Okay, so we'll try to discuss some of these problems tomorrow, but these are very difficult issues. Yeah.
But what is the point of a ksuba? I thought it was to give her some sort of...
Yeah. Well, the problem is the ksuba... Well, the standard ksuba does not have a cost of living clause. That's the problem. Meaning to say that the amount of silver in a ksuba a thousand years ago was enough for a woman to support herself for a year or even 2 years. But the problem is there is no built-in inflation. So therefore it remained at a low level. Now, you can, and Sfardim do this, you can add additional amounts in the ksuba, optionally. And the Gemara encourages...
Is that in
the... No, in the ksuba, there's that, but you can actually add it in the ksuba. You could say, and I hereby add another $1 million. And Sfardim do that. If you ever go to a Sephardic wedding, you will sometimes hear that they'll add like a million shkolim in the ksuba. I mean, they'll really put in a real big amount.
Can you ask add the cost of living?
You can do that also. You can add a cost of living. But the point is, that's not a mandatory part of the ksuba.
Why? That seems very...
Well, in the time of the Chachamim, well, you're right. I think it would make sense to put it in. But in the time of the Chachamim, inflation was much less common. You know, commodities tended to be the same for a very long... In fact, for much of the Middle Ages, for much of world history, there was not a wild fluctuation of prices as we have today. And I believe the rabbinate of Israel, the chief rabbinate, wanted to make a takana to put in a cost of living inflation in the ksuba, but that hasn't been so accepted.
You really can't do that.
We don't really have a mechanism that can make people do it, but you're allowed to do it. So one might say, negotiation to do it, but so far there's no chiyah. Okay, but we'll continue tomorrow.
You think Jewish women don't have a lot of property rights under... divorce.
Right.
Today things are so easy. I mean, sometimes women come to marriage with a great deal of property.
Yes, that's a very important thing. I'll talk about it tomorrow. But yeah,
is common.
Yeah. Basically, I should have said this. In other words, I think it's important to know a woman has very few rights in property that is not in her name. Meaning to say, she does have the right, certainly, to get back the economic value of property that she brought into a marriage.
But what if she, modern times, things are different. What if she went out and while they were married and she got this really great job and made several $100,000 and put it into their joint account?
She would be at...
And he was making, $5 an hour or something. and they get divorced. It's not in her name.
Well,
We'll
discuss it. She might be at a disadvantage in a case like that. She might be at a disadvantage because, generally speaking, her earnings are considered to be property of the husband. But even if the husband is not earning a lot, but not necessarily so, because if the husband is not earning enough to support her, in other words, then in fact her earnings may belong to her, and she may have a claim on them after the divorce. So The one who really is unprotected, I would think, in halacha, in the case of divorce, is a woman who is not the wage earner. If the husband is earning the wages and she did not bring in property, then she's really limited to her ketubah.
Isn't there also a way that before you get married, you can work out a system where the woman's earnings are kept separate?
Yes,
from the husband's
yes, you can. Yes, absolutely. You can work it out. If you didn't work it out, she would be at a disadvantage, but it can be worked out.
I can't remember, because I lived in a couple of different cultures. Is there a custom at any time where the brothers when we get married, they would build a house for their sister?
The brothers? interesting. I don't remember. It sounds vaguely familiar, but I can't say I remember it exactly.
I think it might be a Greek custom. But it seems like there might be something. Now that I'm thinking about it, like in the Song of Songs, that the brothers say, "What shall we give our sister?" or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, that is true. That is true.
I can't remember.
What should we do for our sister on the day that she is spoken for? There is a verse in the Song of Songs. Ma nasel achoseinu b'yom shi'itu barba. Again, that's not necessarily referring to dowries or houses. It seems to be referring to how we check out the guy if he's good enough for our sister. It seems to be kind of the brothers would, look the guy over, type of thing. That's the context. But maybe there is that other thing. I don't know. Interesting reference.
What about the prenuptial agreements? That's often advised by rabbis these days to take out a prenuptial agreement. How will that affect the ketubah?
Yeah, it will change it a lot. The prenuptial agreements would augment the ketubah. So you can have the ketubah, which is a small amount of money.
Instead of writing it into the ketubah, this is an additional
benefit. Right. That's halacha good permitted?
Yes, it is. Right. So prenuptial agreements are very good ways, halachically, to protect the rights of parents. Because the bare halachic ketzuva is largely inadequate because it doesn't have a cost of living.
Uh-huh. Who
provides it? This is the husband's obligation.
The husband.
The husband's obligation to pay his wife upon divorce or upon his death.
For instance, the husband is bankrupt, or has no funds. Who pays it?
Well, nobody pays it. It's a debt. The husband owes the money.
If the husband deserted her?
Well, she has a lien against the estate. She can go against the property. She's like anyone else. She's like anyone else who's owed money. What do I do if somebody owes me money and they don't pay me? But she's owed money. Doesn't mean she'll get it.
Right.
But she's owed the money.
What about with regards to the fact that the wife, her role is to be in the house, to bring up the children, to feed, clothe, whatever, and she's given her husband support for all the years. He's made it a huge success, millions and millions. At the end of the day, all she's entitled to by Jewish law is a year's living. She, in essence, is probably worth half the man's estate.
As you know, this is the basis why.
Right. That,
this is why secular law does this.
I'm asking. How can secular law be better than be more.
Jewish law hasn't been big on divorces to begin with.
Well, that's a lot of it. That's a lot of it. But as I say, see, Jewish law leaves it to the parties to work it out by agreement. So it's not.
It assumes that they're going to be decent and moral.
Make a prenuptial agreement.
Do it prenuptially when they're still decent.
I don't know anything about it.
Okay, we'll talk about it tomorrow because it is. See, you have to understand when we say Jewish law, is perfect. That basically means Jewish law has avenues by which solutions can be. It doesn't mean it imposes it. It creates the framework. Now, it does create a framework where people can work out a fair solution to this. And therefore, as long as it gives you that ability to work it out, that's considered to be adequate. But it doesn't automatically give it. That's right. It's not automatically given.
What about the situation where the wife is the breadwinner and she's the one who's working, and the husband's at home looking after the children.
So she'll probably make a prenuptial agreement also.
So in that case, would the ketubah have to be redrafted in order to...
No, the ketubah still, even if she's a millionaire, the ketubah she's...
But she can get a release from the ketubah, though, can't
she? She can release the ketubah.
Yeah. Yeah.
She has no reason to... Why would she want to do it? But she can release her ketubah.
Right.
Okay, have a good day. Yeah.